Chapter 30. It was a race against death now. That explosives had been placed on the hull was a certainty in Pitt's mind. The Martins had discovered them but were murdered before they could alert Captain Baldwin. Pitt called Giordino over the portable radio. "You can knock off the search and call in the inspectors. The explosives are not inside the ship." Giordino simply acknowledged the message and hurried to the bridge. "What do you know that I don't?" Giordino asked as he rushed through the door, followed by Rand O'Malley. "We just got word that the divers were killed," Pitt told them. "That nails it," Giordino muttered angrily. "The divers inspecting the bottom of the boat?" asked O'Malley. Pitt nodded. "It's beginning to look as though the explosives were set to detonate while we were over deep water." "Which is where we are now," said Giordino quietly, as he stared uneasily at the depth meter. Pitt turned to Baldwin, who was standing at the control console with a helmsman. "How soon before we pass into shallow water?" he asked.
20 minutes will put us over the edge of the trench and onto the continental slope," Baldwin answered, his face beginning to show signs of stress now that he had come to believe his boat was truly in danger. "In 10 more minutes we'll reach the surface, which will enable us to increase our speed by half and reach shallow water." Abruptly, the seaman standing at the ship's main console called out, "Captain, something is happening with the evacuation pods." Baldwin and O'Malley stepped over and stared at the console in shock. All 16 lights representing the evacuation pods were showing red, except for one that still read green.
"They've been activated," Baldwin gasped.
"And before anyone could board," added O'Malley grimly. "We'll never get the crew and passengers off the boat now."
The vision of an explosion on the hull, water flooding inside and dragging the boat unhindered into the abyss with 700 passengers and crew, was too horrible to contemplate, but too real to dismiss. Pitt knew that whoever had activated the evacuation pods had probably abandoned the boat in one of them, which meant that the explosives could detonate at almost any moment. He stepped over to the radar screen that sat side by side with the side-scan sonar display. The continental slope was rising, but too slowly. There were still almost 1,000 feet of water below them. The Golden Marlin's hull was built to withstand the water pressure at that depth, but any hope of rescue would be next to impossible. Every eye stared at the depth meter. Every mind counted the seconds. The seabed rose with agonizing slowness. Only another 100 feet remained before the boat broke the surface. A collective sigh of relief was heard in the control room as the Golden Marlin passed the edge of the continental slope, and the bottom came within 600 feet of the hull. The water outside the viewports was becoming much lighter now, and the restless surface could be seen sparkling under the sun.
"Depth under hull 500 feet and rising," called out Conrad.
The words had barely left his mouth when the boat shuddered with sickening violence. There was barely time to react, to contemplate the inevitable disaster. The boat twisted completely out of control. Those great, technically advanced engines wound down to a stop as the hungry sea poured into the 2 wounds caused by the underwater explosives. The Golden Marlin lay motionless, drifting in the mild current, but sinking foot by inexorable foot toward the seafloor. Tons of water began flooding into the hull in locations yet unknown to the men in the control room. The surface looked so tantalizingly near, it seemed as if it could be touched with a yardstick. Baldwin was under no illusions. His boat was going down.
"Call the engine room and ask the chief to ascertain the damage," he snapped to his second officer. The reply came back almost immediately. "The chief engineer reports they're taking water in the engine room. The baggage compartment is also flooding, but the hull is still intact. He has the pumps flowing at maximum capacity. He also reports that the ballast tank pump system was damaged by the forward blast water and is pouring into the tanks through the exhaust tubes. The crew is struggling to shut down the flow, but the water is rising too fast, and they may have to evacuate the engine room."
"I'm sorry, sir. The chief says
He can no longer keep the boat from losing neutral buoyancy. Oh, God, murmured a young officer standing at the control console. We're going to sink. Baldwin quickly came on keel. Tell the chief to close all the watertight doors below and keep the generators going as long as he can. Then he looked at Pitt, silent, expressionless, and said, Well, Mr. Pitt, I guess now is the time for you to tell me I told you so. Pitt's face was set, stonily, thoughtful, the face of a man who was considering every possible contingency, every potential to save the ship and its passengers. Giordino had seen the look many times in the past. Pitt shook his head slowly. I take no satisfaction in being right. Bottom coming up! First Officer Conrad's eyes had never left the radar and side-scan sonar displays. He had no sooner spoken the words when the Golden Marlin struck the seafloor with a loud creaking and groaning sounds of protest as her hull settled into the silt, throwing up a vast brown cloud that blotted out all vision beyond the viewports. He didn't take a motion picture of the event for the passengers to know something very tragic was in the making. Yet as long as the passenger decks remained water-free and none of the crew looked frightened, since this was their first voyage in a submarine, none of them realized what real danger they were in, no one panicked. Captain Baldwin came on the speaker system and assured everyone that although the Golden Marlin had lost power, things would be back to normal shortly. The story, however, did not fly with the passengers and crew who'd noticed that almost all the pod chambers were empty. Some milled around in confusion. Some remained at the viewports and gazed at the fish who appeared after the silt settled. Some retired to the lounge and ordered drinks that were now on the house. Captain Baldwin and his officers began studying emergency procedures that came out of corporate manuals written by those who had no concept of how to deal with a submarine cruise liner lying helpless on the bottom with 700 souls on board. While the hull was sounded to make certain it was still mostly watertight and the bulkhead doors closed, the engineering crew set the pumps in operation to keep up with the sea flowing into the engine room and baggage compartment. Fortunately, all the systems but propulsion appeared unaffected by damage from the explosions. Baldwin sat in the communications room like a man in a daze. With great effort, he opened up communications with Lash at the company headquarters, the Coast Guard, and any ships that were within 50 miles in that order. He issued a mayday and gave the Golden Marlin's position. That done, he sat back and laid his head in his hands. At first, he worried that his long career at sea would be ended. Then it came to him how unimportant his career was under the circumstances. His first duty was to his passengers and crew. Damn the career, he muttered under his breath. He stood and walked from the bridge, first to the engine room for a full report, and then he roamed the ship, reassuring the passengers that they were in no immediate danger. He gave out the story that there was a problem with the ballast tanks, and repairs were in effect. Together, Pitt, Giordino, and O'Malley went down to the evacuation pod deck. O'Malley began opening inspection panels and checking the system. There was something oddly reassuring about the big Irishman. He knew his job and knew it well. No lost motion with him. Less than 5 minutes after he began his inspection, he stepped back from the open panels, sat down in a chair, and sighed. Whoever activated the evacuation pods knew his business. He overrode the circuits leading to the bridge and set the pods in motion by using the emergency manual controls. Luckily, it looks like one pod failed to release. Small consolation, muttered Giordino. Pitt slowly shook his head in defeat. They've been two steps ahead of us from the beginning. I have to give them an A for planning. Who's they? Asked O'Malley. Men who will murder children as easily as you and I would kill flies. It makes no sense. Not to sane people. We still have one pod to put the children in, said Giordino. It's the captain's job to give the order, Pitt said, staring at the remaining pod. The question is, how many can we put in it? An hour later, a Coast Guard cutter arrived on the scene, hauled aboard the orange marker buoy released from the Golden Marlin with a telephone line, and opened communications to the boat. Only then did Baldwin give the command to gather the passengers into the theater and explain the situation. He concentrated on minimizing the danger and stated that it was in keeping with company regulations to send the youngest to the surface in case of an emergency. None of it sat well. Questions were raised, tempers flared, and it was all the captain could do to defuse the anger and fear. Before the pod was loaded, Pitt and O'Malley sat at a computer in the purser's office and estimated the number of bodies the pod could carry beyond the safe limits, as stated by the manufacturer, and still float free to the surface. While they were absorbed in their work, Giordino left them to look for Kelly. "How many children on board?" asked O'Malley. Using the purser's list of passengers, Pitt totaled up the number. 54 who are under the age of 18. The pods are constructed to carry 50 people with an average weight of 160 pounds, for a total weight limit of 8,000 pounds. Anything above that, and they won't float to the surface. We can cut that figure in half. The kids should average around 80 pounds or less. Now that we're down to 4,000 pounds, that leaves room for some of them others, said O'Malley, feeling odd to be discussing whose lives would be saved. Take an average weight of 140, and we have room for nearly 29 mothers. O'Malley punched up the families and number of children. There are 27 mothers on board, he said, with a hint of optimism. Thank God we can evacuate all of them and their children. We have to ignore the new tradition of keeping families together, said Pitt. The men make up too much weight. I agree, O'Malley said heavily. We still have room for one or two more bodies. We can't exactly ask the other 617 passengers and crew to draw straws. No, said Pitt. We have to send someone, one of us, who can give a detailed report on the situation down here that can't be fully interpreted through underwater communications. I'm more important here, O'Malley said firmly. Giordino returned at that moment. The expression on his face was not one of pleasure. Kelly has disappeared, he said simply. I put together a search party, but we can find no trace of her. Bloody hell, Pitt swore. He did not question Giordino, did not doubt for a moment that Kelly had indeed vanished. Gut instinct alone told him it was true. Suddenly the photo of a passenger filled his mind. He programmed in the passenger list on the computer and typed the name Jonathan Ford. The picture of Ford, taken as he stepped off the gangway onto the deck, filled the monitor. Next, Pitt hit the print key and waited until a colored image rolled from the printer. While O'Malley and Giordino stood silent, he studied the face, comparing it mentally with the pilot of the Red Fokker he'd met at the air show before the dogfight. He took the image over to a desk, took a pencil, and began shading in the man's face. When he was finished, he felt as if a fist had struck him in the stomach. He was here on board. And I missed him. Completely adrift, O'Malley asked, "Who are you talking about?" "The man who nearly killed me, along with a plane load of children in New York, and the one responsible for us lying helpless on the bottom and releasing empty evacuation pods. I'm afraid that he escaped in one of the pods and took Kelly with him." Giordino placed a hand on Pitt's shoulder. He could appreciate how bad Pitt felt. He felt that he had failed as well, and it came back to haunt him. Pitt made a mental note of Ford's stateroom number and hurried out into the passageway, followed by Giordino and O'Malley. Pitt was not in any frame of mind to take the time to ask the stateroom stewardess for a key. He hauled off and kicked the door open. The stewardess had made up the room, but there was no sign of luggage. Pitt pulled open the drawers of the dressers. They were bare. Giordino opened the closet and saw a white object far up on the top shelf. He reached up and pulled down a thick roll of paper and spread it out on the bed. "The blueprints of the boat," muttered O'Malley. "Where did he get them?" A chill ran through Pitt's body as he realized that seizing Kelly had been another one of Ford's assignments. He's backed by a superb intelligence operation. He was able to familiarize himself with every system and piece of equipment, every deck, bulkhead, and structure in exacting detail. Which explains how he knew where to place the explosives and manually activate the evacuation pods, said O'Malley. There's nothing more we can do here, said Giordino, except notify the Coast Guard on the surface to look for a vessel that was hovering over the area to pick this character and Kelly out of the pod. Accepting Ford's escape and Kelly's abduction as horrible reality, Pitt felt a deep sense of grotesque inadequacy and futility. He was totally powerless to help or rescue her. Pitt sagged dejectedly into a chair. He felt an even deadlier chill pass through him, and this one had nothing to do with Kelly's fate. All the pods were gone, and there was no way they could be retrieved and loaded again. He saw little hope of saving the other 600-plus souls on board the sunken cruise liner. He sat there listlessly for a few seconds, then looked into the silent and expectant face of O'Malley and said softly, "You know every corner of the boat." He said it as a statement of fact rather than a question. O'Malley hesitated, not sure of Pitt's intent. "Yes, I know her as well as anyone." "Is there another evacuation system besides the pods?" "I'm not clear what you mean." "Did the boat builder install a backup airlock system for a chamber rescue?"
"You mean a specially configured hatch on the top of the hull?"
"Exactly."
"Yes, there is one, but there is no way all 600 of us can be rescued before we run out of air."
"How so?" asked Giordino. "As we speak, rescue operations are underway."
"You don't know?"
"Only if you don't tell us," Pitt said harshly. The Golden Marlin was never designed to remain underwater for more than 4 days before surfacing. After that, the air quickly becomes unbreathable.
"I thought the air regenerators refreshed the inside atmosphere indefinitely," said Giordino in surprise.
O'Malley shook his head.
"They're very efficient. They do a first-rate job of refreshing the air, but after a while, the combined carbon dioxide buildup from 700 humans in an enclosed atmosphere becomes too much for the scrubbers and filters. Then the air purification begins to break down."
He shrugged darkly. "All this speculation goes out the window if the flooding gets to the generator and we lose power. Then the air regeneration equipment will shut down." 4 days, if we're lucky, Pitt said slowly. 3.5, actually, since we've already been down almost 12 hours since we submerged.
The U.S. Navy has a deep submergence rescue vehicle that can do the job, said Giordino.
Yes, but mobilization, transporting it, and the operating team to the site, and then setting up the rescue procedures could easily take 4 days.
O'Malley spoke slowly, emphatically. By the time they drop it down and lock up with the air escape chamber, it will be too late to save more than a handful of us.
Pitt turned to Giordino. Al, you've got to go topside with the mothers and children. For perhaps 5 incredulous seconds, Giordino stood there, looking blank. When shocked realization did come, his voice became indignant.
Mrs. Giordino's boy is no coward. I won't jump ship hiding behind women's skirts.
Believe me, old friend, Pitt entreated. You can do far more to save everyone by working with me from the surface.
Giordino started to say, why don't you go?
But thought better of it and accepted Pitt's reasoning as correct.
Okay. Once I reach the surface, what then? It's essential that we get an open line down here to purify the air. And just where am I supposed to scare up 500 feet of hose, an air pump capable of pumping enough air to keep 617 people alive until rescue, and a method of attaching it to the sunken boat?
Pitt looked at his old pal of almost 40 years and grinned.
If I know you, you'll think of something.